Chapter 4. Poplar. Josiah Sanchez was very confused. The last thing he remembered was listening to Lieutenant Anderson's issues with insecurity. Her therapist disappearing before her eyes while unburdening herself to him would play with her treatment. When he appeared within the church's walls, which was the usual environment of the preacher he played in the Magnificent Seven program, Josiah thought this was someone's idea of a joke. Although he loved spontaneity like the next man, the counselor did not appreciate it when he was in session with a patient. He materialized at the pulpit and stood there for a few moments, overcoming his disorientation. Annoyance filled him at his forced removal from his patient to arrive at this holodeck simulation without consent. At first, Josiah attributed this bout of mischief-making to the first officer, since practical jokes seemed to be Buck's habit. However, despite the considered opinions of most, Buck had limits, and spiriting someone away without their consent fell under that category. Josiah elected to postpone the debate over the guilty party in this, since he was eager to get back to Lieutenant Anderson, who would probably never trust a counselor again. Unfortunately, nothing had happened when he asked the computer to produce the doorway, allowing him to escape from this world of shadow and light. Outside, he could still hear hoofs against gravel surfaces, people talking and going about their business, and all the sounds and smells that came with existence in a town of the Old West. Josiah tried several times to coax the uncooperative computer into letting him out of there before he accepted he was going nowhere. Finally, he sat down on a pew to consider his thoughts. There was no way he was getting out of here on his own. He was a counselor, and the science behind holographic projections was beyond him. Yet, he was painfully aware if he did not understand it, he would go nowhere. He also considered whether he was alone here. If someone sent him to the place occupied by the character he played in the simulation, it would be logical to assume the others would have been subject to the same displacement. If that were the case, then Julia Pemberton would also be here, because she also played a character in the Magnificent Seven myth. If anyone could get themselves out of this fantasy world, it was the chief engineer of the Maverick, so Josiah would have to go find her. The emporium her character owned was close to his church, and Josiah knew if Julia were here against her will, she would look for a way out of this simulated world. He had better find her quickly. Josiah did not want her to leave without him. He stood up to depart when suddenly a man appeared at the church's main doors. He startled Josiah with his presence, and the counselor wondered how long he had been standing there.
"May I help you?"
Josiah asked, wishing the computer recognized his commands so he could make the character disappear without requiring to interact with it.
"Mr. Sanchez."
He was a young man, not much older than Ben, Josiah estimated. He was handsome, but something in his face was inherently unappealing to look at for long. His eyes, which were the most telling thing about him, were uncertain yet calculating. Whoever designed this holographic character was a genius, because Josiah could see a dozen neuroses simmering under those watery colored eyes.
"Yes."
Josiah nodded, studying him closely now, tendrils of caution sneaking up his spine. His visitor wore a tweed suit cut in the fashion of the day. He appeared neatly dressed despite the dust that coated everything in this world. He studied Josiah with almost the same scrutiny Josiah observed him. They resembled two lions circling each other, waiting for the optimum moment to attack.
"My name is Silas Poplar. I am a Pinkerton detective."
Josiah thought quickly, trying to remember what that name meant. He didn't have a clue.
"What can I do for a Pinkerton detective?"
"You traveled to Vesta City 2 days ago,"
Poplar responded smoothly. His voice was syrupy but seemed to drag across the ground like glass when he spoke. Josiah supposed Poplar must have been referring to the exploits of his character.
"I did."
"May I inquire what you were doing there?"
A flash of insight told Josiah he was being interrogated. Poplar had the tone Ezra Standish used when the personality of the charming gambler gave way for the needlepoint acuity of the security chief.
"Nothing that is any of your concern unless you wish to tell me what this is all about,"
Josiah countered, suddenly realizing he ought to be careful with what he said around this man. Until he could escape the program, Josiah was at the mercy of the scenario and the characters within it. Poplar smiled, but it was devoid of humor or pleasure. Instead, it looked rather like the expression of an animal baring its teeth before it lunged in for the kill.
"Of course. There were two murders in Vesta City at the time of your stay. I believe you were involved."
Josiah showed no reaction.
"Really?"
"You seemed unsurprised by the accusation,"
Poplar declared, his eyes narrowing in calculation.
"How is that, Mr. Sanchez?" most men would react on some level.
Are you a student of psychoanalytic behavior?
Josiah looked at him with equal intensity.
I cannot say that I am.
The man gave him a look that showed his surprise at Josiah even knowing that field of study, let alone ask him the question.
Then you are unable to interpret human response, are you? I am an interested observer of body language, and my reaction is of one who has not committed the crime or has, on any level, one attached to him. That would explain my detachment, would it not?
It could mean you are an excellent actor.
Poplar returned, unprepared to be outdone by this preacher in this forgotten town, collecting dust with each breath of wind.
And I could say the same of you.
Josiah answered, in perfect control of the game they were playing, and it was a game they were currently engaged in. There was no doubt in his mind. Poplar was a man who got by on intimidation. And Josiah had been in the business of psychoanalysis far too long to not recognize the pattern of behavior the man was displaying.
You've played many games in your life, have you not, Mr. Poplar?
The counselor asked softly, using the voice that lulled many patients into complacency. He circled Poplar as the man held still, somewhat trapped by the consistency of his words, like all those who were supremely arrogant and felt some insular need to hear themselves spoken about as an object under glass.
I wager you are very good at games involving power and subjugation. You enjoy using your authority to keep those you wish to dominate pinned down and unable to fight, perhaps fulfilling some inner need to be strong when you are trapped in amber, unable to move or scream.
Poplar's eyes flew open, and he glared at Josiah with nothing less than hatred as the words bounced off his skin like rain. His breathing had become shallow, and when he finally spoke, it was soft and uncertain, lacking the confidence he used to accuse Josiah of murder a few minutes ago.
You're very good at fabrication, Mr. Sanchez. Perhaps that is how you lured your victims to you.
Do you have any proof I killed those women?
Poplar's bobbing Adam's apple answered for him before the words escaped his lips.
I will find some.
Then until you do.
The counselor started towards the door.
I'll be on my way.
He left Poplar in his church without waiting for a response. The man said nothing as Josiah made his departure. The counselor was sure as long as he remained in this simulation in its present scenario, with no means to alter its programming, his troubles with Mr. Poplar were just beginning. The summer's day had disappeared behind thick gray clouds when Josiah left his church. In the distance, the wind was being stirred into a frenzy as a dust storm appeared on the horizon with four corners in its path. Josiah did not get very far toward the Emporium when he noticed a crowd gathered in a side alley, rumbling with discontent as they surrounded something he could not see. Although he had no time for such lingering, Josiah's curiosity got the better of him. Whatever was happening, this fantasy world seemed to be its epicenter, and Josiah ought to be aware of everything if he was to navigate it safely. His approach immediately caused a swell of relief from the townsfolk, who saw him not as the counselor he was but as one of the seven peacekeepers charged to protect their community. Mr. Wallace, the owner of the hardware store and one of Four Corners town leaders, met him as he approached. The man's expression was grim and appeared as if his last meal had left an unpleasant taste in his mouth. As Josiah and Wallace reached the thick of the crowd, they stepped aside for him. Whatever they saw had left its mark upon them, as the distress on their faces was plain. He braced himself for the worst. Nathan Jackson leaned over a young woman, and when Nathan looked over his shoulder to meet Josiah's eyes, the counselor knew immediately it mattered little if she was a hologram or flesh and blood. The doctor felt the death just as profoundly. The woman over whom Nathan was kneeling was young and pretty, with light strands of blonde hair splayed gently around her head as if the killer who placed her in this resting place did not wish her to appear disheveled. She was only 30, Josiah estimated, wearing a red dress with dainty white flowers printed against its crimson backdrop. There were ribbons in her hair, and Josiah ached, wondering if they held those lovely locks in place for expediency or because she wanted to look pretty for someone. However, his observations shifted to the placement of her body in the middle of the street. It was laid to rest by someone who seemed almost reverent in his actions. She looked like she was sleeping rather than dead. Where her eyes should have been staring lifelessly back at him were two silver dollars gleaming under the sun. Josiah winced and searched for the cause of death. The ligature marks he spied around her throat was answer enough.
How long, Nathan?
Josiah asked, noticing the shock on the faces of the onlookers. Understandable, he thought. She was someone they knew, someone they saw every day. Holograms or not, their grief was genuine.
I can't say. A few hours.
The doctor conducted further examinations before pushing himself to his feet. Nathan's posture took on the haunched, supplicating gait of one about to deliver devastating news about a loved one. At the fringes of the crowd, the undertaker and his assistant soon arrived to take the body away for preparation and eventually burial. Wallace turned to Josiah.
You've got to catch this man. You've got to catch him. Our women won't feel safe until you do.
Josiah gazed at the ladies in the crowd who saw the body, whose eyes showed their sorrow and fear. Yes, they would indeed feel that way, and rightly so. Everything Josiah could see about this crime told him this was not the actions of someone who had just learned to murder, but someone who had honed his craft, probably through trial and error. This killer would hunt his fellow man like a hunter on safari. This would happen again and again until his capture. For this predator, it was an obsession that could end in no other way.
We'll do what we can,
Josiah assured him, and then stared at the surrounding people.
Come on now, you've all seen enough. Let these good men here do what's proper for her.
He gestured towards the undertakers, trying to make their way through the bystanders to take the young woman away. The crowd withdrew further as the morticians took charge of the body. Some stayed a little longer, wishing to see the entire drama of the body being placed on the stretcher and removed. Others went shortly after Josiah finished his speech, realizing he was right. The sideshow was over. Josiah and Nathan looked at each other and waited until Wallace and everyone else had gone from the street before they would discuss the other matter at hand. Wallace returned to his hardware store. The undertakers, solemn in their duty and practiced, ferried the young woman away from the street where she met her premature end. Nathan's expression was particularly gray, and Josiah wondered about the reason for such hollowness. As much as Josiah hated seeing that girl dead, the truth of the matter was simply she was not alive to begin with. She was a creation of the holodeck, and if she died here, there was no soul lost, just the termination of one character from the program.
What the hell is going on here?
Nathan asked venomously once they were completely alone.
Who thinks it's funny to drag me out of a delivery to be placed here, looking over that poor child?
I don't know. I had the same problem. One minute I was talking to Lieutenant Anderson, the next minute I'm here. Not to mention the holodeck controls aren't working. I was on my way to find Julia when I saw you.
Yeah, that sounds like a plan.
Nathan nodded, now that he had time to think. He materialized before a dead body and spent all the time since his arrival dealing with it. Even now, something bothered him about the dead girl.
Josiah, do you remember much about the Magnificent Seven legend?
No, not really. I knew they were seven gunfighters protecting a small frontier town. There were additional characters, you know, obligatory love interests of the day, but none of the specifics.
Oh.
Nathan frowned as they resumed walking towards the Emporium, since there was nothing to be done now following the victim's removal.
It's just that I know something of the legend, and I don't remember this story being a part of it.
What about a Pinkerton detective named Poplar?
Josiah inquired, remembering his encounter with the odious man who accused him of murder. Josiah supposed the discovery of a body in Four Corners would fuel the fire of Poplar's belief he was responsible for the deaths. The counselor sighed, realizing he would soon get another visit from Poplar with more wild accusations. Nathan thought for a moment, seeking the name in his memory, and shook his head when he could not.
I've never heard of him.
Well, I had a visit from him when I showed up here, and let me tell you, he thinks I did these murders.
What?
Nathan looked at him with astonishment, unable to imagine such a thing.
That's crazy!
Nathan exclaimed in nothing less than outrage and disgust.
I know that, but I also think he is something to be worried about.
Josiah knew what he saw in Poplar's eyes. He had been a counselor for a long time and had seen enough patients to recognize the seeds of aberrant behavior. Poplar had all the symptoms of such a dangerous condition.
He thinks he's on a crusade, and such men are dangerous. No doubt Torquemada thought he was acting on God's word when he tortured all those people, interpreting the voices in his head, perhaps his neuroses, as the Almighty speaking to him.
You think he'll come after you even if he can't prove it?
Nathan looked at Josiah with growing concern.
He looks the kind that's about to slip over the edge. I believe he has sociopathic tendencies, and if someone trapped us in this simulation with no way out, then we have to deal with him in this environment.
God!
The doctor groaned, realizing at this point how being black in this day and age would affect him. The idea of a doctor being black was almost unheard of, and some people would kill to prevent it.
We better find Julia quickly.
No sooner than Nathan made that statement, Julia Pemberton appeared out of the front door of the Pemberton Emporium. She wore a lavender gown, looking the beauty her character intended to be. Her eyes flooded with relief when she saw them across the street. Raising her skirts to descend the painted wooden stairs, she smiled when she finally joined Nathan and Josiah.
Thank God you guys are here. I thought I was going crazy.
You got taken from where you were, too.
Josiah's theory that all the bridge crew members were being abducted was further confirmed.
Yes, I was in a maintenance shaft fixing a relay when I came here.
Have you also noticed we can't access the holodeck controls?
Nathan prayed she wasn't as trapped here as they were.
I have. I can't get anything to work. The computer won't accept any kind of voice command at all.
So, how do we get out?
If I can't access the computer to give me manual control, we'll have to rely on the outside getting us out.
Julia gave them apologetic expressions, wishing she could offer them better news.
You mean we're stuck here until someone from the outside discovers we're in here? I can't be trapped in here indefinitely. I've got people to tend to. An entire ship who needs my help.
Hey!
Julia snapped sharply, reminding Nathan she was just as helpless. Understanding the technology of this place was something she was a master at, yet she could do nothing to aid their situation.
I am not thrilled about this, either. The Maverick is as much your ship as it is mine, and while you safeguard the crew, I do the same for the ship, and I'm telling you, we can't leave. The holodeck is a matter of perception, and at the moment, for me to find the manual control panel is impossible if the computer is compensating for my visual perception of the simulation. We could stand next to the thing, but the computer will never let us near it because, as far as it's concerned, it has to maintain the illusion of four corners for us.
Nathan threw his hand up in exasperation.
You know, you hear about these stupid holodeck accidents, and you think it's an exaggeration, but it's not. This is dangerous. Do we even know if the safety protocols are on?
Julia shrugged her shoulders in an answer and shook her head.
Oh, great. We could die in here.
All right, let's just calm down. Nathan, Julia.
He gave them both the Josiah Sanchez special, stare coined by Chris Larrabee to be a look of disapproval so effective that even a captain flinched.
You are friends. We need to work together to get out of here, and we will not do this by climbing up the walls. Am I right?
Yes, Josiah.
Josiah.
They replied guiltily.
All right.
Josiah sighed, using the same voice he used on his children when they were misbehaving.
Now, let's think about how we are getting out of here.
From a distance, Silas Poplar watched. He did not know the content of Josiah's conversation with the tall black man, and he really did not care, but he paid attention when she arrived. She was the most beautiful creature he had ever seen, but then all the women he ever graced with his touch were spectacular in their own way. Poplar watched the lovely woman with the fiery colored hair and the glittering emerald eyes with desire. He simply had to have her. And it made it even more convenient Josiah knew her too, for when the deed was done, Poplar could use the relationship to his own ends. He turned away, not wishing to be seen, and slipped his hand into his pocket, where he felt the cool, comforting sensation against his fingertips of a shiny silver dollar. Chapter 5. Alive. J.D. Dunn still had difficulty believing this was anything more than someone's idea of a practical joke. When he materialized here from his room, he thought this was probably a prank cooked up by the first officer. Only Buck would have the audacity and the knowledge to perpetrate such a kidnapping. Not that J.D. minded. He enjoyed the Magnificent Seven program. As a form of recreation, he could think of nothing more exciting than playing one of the seven gunfighters who protected the town of Four Corners. Besides, the bonus of the story meant he got to be sheriff. Still, despite his lack of concern at being brought here so abruptly, he wished Buck could have at least asked him or given him some warning before transporting him here. Although J.D. did not mind taking part, he didn't want to stay long because he was tired and needed sleep. However, materializing in the jailhouse alone was puzzling. At first, he assumed it was part of the game scenario, but after 20 minutes ticked by with nothing happening inside or out, J.D. decided it was time to investigate. The office he occupied was typical of the jailhouses scattered throughout the West during this period of Earth's history. The gloomy collection of empty cells was furnished with bunks and little else. The sheriff's space fared no better. His bastion was a chair and desk, with wanted posters hanging on the walls. Getting up from his desk, JD headed towards the door, hoping to find Buck to learn what was happening. He pulled open the door just as Vin Tanner was about to do the same. Behind the officer of the con were Chris Larrabee and Ezra Standish, keeping a cautious eye on their surroundings. Their demeanor immediately put the young man on guard, even though he did not know why. The three senior officers seemed relieved to see him, further adding to JD's puzzlement.
Captain,
JD greeted.
Buck brought you here too.
Buck didn't bring us here, JD.
Vin grumbled as Chris shut the door behind him and Ezra immediately took point at the window so he could have an unobstructed view of the street.
He didn't.
It never occurred to JD that being here was anything more than Buck Wilmington's prank. The first officer had a very peculiar sense of humor, but now JD thought about it, supposed even Buck had his limits, especially if it involved the captain. While Chris was very accommodating as far as commanding officers went, JD didn't think he would tolerate being spirited off his bridge, even if it were his oldest friend committing the act.
I'm guessing you haven't tried getting out.
Vin asked as Chris sat down in the chair JD previously occupied, examining the weapon Ezra gave him in the saloon. The captain was trying to figure out exactly how the thing worked, having no wish to enter another round with Top Hat Bob so disadvantaged.
No.
JD shook his head.
I just figured Buck brought me here and everything going on was part of the simulation. I only thought maybe I ought to find him when it was quiet for so long, and nobody was turning up. But then I opened the door, and there you were.
For once, Mr. Wilmington is not responsible for this little jaunt into Wonderland.
Ezra drawled from where he was.
No kidding.
Vin remarked, recalling how annoyed Buck had been when they last saw the man.
He was just as pissed off as we were at being taken off the bridge and sent here.
I'm sorry, Captain.
JD apologized, feeling immensely foolish for not realizing the situation was this serious.
I should have realized that something was wrong.
It's all right, JD, Chris answered and gave him a little smile to think nothing of it. None of us were any surer of things ourselves, even with the benefit of experience.
Why would JD suspect this was simply Buck's idea of a joke? Had not Chris thought the same thing when he first materialized here? Vin and Ezra exchanged a brief glimpse and a smile as they saw JD immediately swelling with pleasure at the captain's kind words. Both men did not say what they were thinking, even though their eye contact spoke volumes. Chris engendered the loyalty he did from his crew, not simply from the senior staff, due to his ability to make every single member of the Maverick feel like they mattered. He treated every member of his crew, from the first officer to the stewards in the lower decks, like they were a vital component in the Maverick's machinery.
So we're trapped in here?
JD asked, unable to hide his apprehension at the notion they could not escape from this simulated reality. Coming here for recreational purposes was one thing, but being trapped here was something else entirely. He was a product of his time and did not crave the nostalgic days of old.
More or less.
Ezra Standish peeked out the window, ensuring they did not have another altercation with Top Hat Bob. Fortunately, Bob did not appear to be anywhere in the immediate vicinity. The security chief decided it was more or less safe for them to attempt their rendezvous with the others.
Unfortunately, it also appears the safety protocols have also been disabled.
Disabled? Oh, this just gets better.
The young man forgot he was an ensign surrounded by three command officers.
Not to mention, we're seeing some pretty interesting villains.
We have.
JD asked quizzically. When first invited to join this program, JD studied everything available on the mythology of the Magnificent Seven. JD was so honored to be invited to join the captain's private recreational world that he didn't want to embarrass himself by being unprepared. Even though they treated him with respect and friendship, JD still felt insecure about being surrounded by veteran officers who were all exceptional. It made him work twice as hard to keep up with them. He took the Magnificent Seven program just as seriously, memorizing every legend and villain the lawmen faced during their extraordinary tenure in the town of Four Corners.
An odious specimen called Top Hat Bob accosted us,
Ezra answered before Vin could.
The man seemed to think the captain had wronged him somehow.
Top Hat Bob,
JD mused. The name sounded familiar, and JD thought about it for a moment.
Does he have an eye patch?
All three men raised their eyes to the youth, but Chris answered.
He has an eye patch.
Oh, Top Hat Bob?
JD exclaimed, recognizing the character.
I thought we covered that already,
Vin said impatiently.
Sorry.
JD gave the tracker an embarrassed smile and continued.
Top Hat Bob is a Magnificent Seven villain, but not an important one. He's mostly a hired gun but has a personal grudge against the gunfighter.
Because? While he had enjoyed the program ever since Buck presented it to him as a birthday present shortly after coming on board the Maverick, Chris confessed to not knowing every aspect of the lore regarding the seven legendary gunmen.
Something about a wood-splitting contest or something?
JD answered with a frown because the facts were rather vague on the exact details of the character's vendetta.
I know it was a contest he lost and got into a brawl with the gunfighter, where he lost his eye.
Terrific. I wonder how many others will come out of the woodwork? The captain let out a sigh before pushing himself to his feet.
Others?
Vin looked at him.
There is no reason to assume that there will not be.
Ezra agreed with the captain's prediction in this matter.
Someone is playing games with us, and if you're a pawn in someone else's amusement, there is no doubt they will want to make the games as entertaining as possible.
Chris stared at Ezra, feeling something spark in his memory at the security chief's words. He searched his mind for why Ezra's words felt so familiar, but it was gone before he could understand why.
Chris?
Vin, who knew his expressions with almost intimate knowledge, saw the uncertainty in his eyes even for a second.
What is it?
Nothing. Chris shook his head, unable to solve the riddle of Ezra's comment. Come on, let's get to the rendezvous point. However, the uneasiness still would not go away. Less than 10 minutes after they collected JD at the jailhouse, Chris and the entire senior staff of the Maverick found themselves gathered around what was usually their table at the tavern owned by the gambler con man Ezra took such delight in playing. Although it was not the practice of the day for the ladies and their group to be in such an establishment, Chris decided decorum be damned. They had more significant concerns on their hands at the moment. Judging by the experiences related by the rest of the Maverick's senior staff, the mysterious culprit who had placed them in this recreation of their holodeck fantasy was taking pleasure in pitting them against a full array of magnificent seven villains. As it was, the shiner Mary wore on her face made Chris want to kick the crap out of Mr. Wicks.
It's like a Batman movie,
Mary declared. Chris stared at her. A what?
Never mind.
Mary shrugged in response, not about to reveal her preference for 20th century comic books.
What are we going to do? The Antarians are less than a day away. We have to get out of here.
One disaster at a time.
Buck was sure Chris was just as tired as he was about being reminded about this deadline.
At the moment, we need to figure out how we will get out of here.
All right, let's examine our situation, Chris said firmly, speaking with just enough authority to remind those present they were not in a holodeck fantasy despite their current situation. They were Starfleet officers in an alien and hostile environment, and it was time they started behaving like it.
Someone brought us to what I am fairly certain is not our holodeck program, throwing every conceivable villain they can think of at us.
Chris, I'm not so sure this is a holographic illusion.
What else could it be?
Josiah inquired.
This can't exist anywhere in reality.
Why do you think that, Lieutenant?
Ezra asked, keeping his gaze fixed at one point and fighting the urge to let his eyes wander. Although he was mindful of their situation, he could not help being distracted by Julia's presence, especially when she sat right across the table from him. Julia avoided meeting his eyes, and Ezra wondered if she was just as uncomfortable as he was about the state of their relationship. Once again, Ezra cursed the circumstances that brought them to this. Mary glanced at Chris, always feeling uncomfortable when discussing this subject, rare as it was. She was human, and her psi ability was weak. Most of the time, her extrasensory powers did not manifest themselves as any more than a strong intuition.
I get a sense of these people.
She looked around the room at the barmaid who looked like Inez, the patrons downing drinks, and the saloon girls.
My mind tells me they're not real. They're light and magnetic containment projections, but they feel real to me.
I know what you mean.
Nathan frowned, remembering the young woman he had stood over a short time ago. She, with the ribbons in her hair, staring at him with silver coins in her eyes. She did not seem like a fake, but flesh and blood.
They feel like real people.
That's programming.
Julia scoffed. The engineer in her refused to believe in something as intangible as a feeling. She dealt in numbers and facts she could see, in laws of physics and proven science.
They are supposed to look and feel real.
But you don't know that it is.
Vin countered.
We're all energy in some way. Who knows what makes one thing alive and another an object? We live in a universe with android officers and holographic programs with recognized sentience. We don't know how to classify life, not really.
Spoken like a true Starfleet officer.
Buck remembered a dozen Starfleet lecturers making the same points at the academy.
Thanks.
Vin returned after Buck's comment. What Mary said seemed to make a certain amount of sense. Chris knew her latent telepathic abilities were nothing to ignore or underestimate. On the Kakaya ship, those powers saved both their lives, and he was not about to disregard them.
Mary, when you say you get some sense of them, what do you mean?
I don't know.
She admitted with some exasperation.
I feel them, but not quite. Normally when I'm in the holodeck, the people we see don't register. They're not alive. It's like seeing any inanimate object. It doesn't register with me. But this is different. They're like shadows. Alive but not alive. I can't explain it.
Maybe Mr. Tanner.
Ezra suggested.
Me?
Vin stared back at the security chief, perplexed. Alex understood immediately.
Vin, you need to do a meld.
A meld?
He almost shouted before a stern look from his captain reminded him to lower his voice. They were bringing enough attention to themselves by having the girls in here without Vin's outburst adding to it.
Why?
You're Vulcan.
Alex gave Ezra a glance that told him to let her handle this.
Tell me something I don't know.
He bit back impatiently.
I wasn't sure with the ears.
Alex bristled and was about to respond when Chris intervened before they both said something they would regret. If there was one thing that could make Vin lose his temper, even with Alex, it was discussing his Vulcan background. Like the rest of his race, Vin found the subject deeply personal. Vin, Chris responded, placing a gentle hand on Alex's arm. The science officer took the hint and immediately withdrew in favor of the captain. Alex hated discussing this subject with Vin because he was so sensitive about it. Provoking Vin's temper would provoke hers, and since she could not have her way with him, it was a passion she would prefer not to ignite.
You're far more capable of telling us if these people are more than what they seem. We need to know for sure to figure out what to do next.
It's insane.
Julia insisted.
It's a program, I'm telling you.
We cannot make that determination simply because it looks like one.
Ezra countered.
Something appearing to be something else didn't seem to bother you before.
What is that supposed to mean?
Ezra met her gaze sharply.
I think you know.
I think I don't give a goddamn hell what either of you know.
Chris hissed with a low snarl and immediately silenced both of them. Julia's cheeks flushed red, and Ezra did not have to brave a look in Chris's direction to feel the Larrabee glare burning into him. The others found it the perfect time to clear their throats, avert their gazes, or do anything that kept them from making eye contact.
Now you listen to me, Commander Standish and Lieutenant Pemberton.
Chris's patience was not infinite, but the bickering and snide remarks traded between these two since the incident with the Akrins were plain pissing him off. He waited for the duo to settle this like adults, but it was their business if they didn't. However, the minute it interfered with their duty as officers, it became his.
We are in a life and death situation here, and I don't care if you are having relationship troubles and can barely stomach the sight of each other, but while you are under my command, you will behave accordingly.
I apologize, sir.
The security chief said, suitably mortified by his lack of professionalism.
Likewise, Captain.
Julia answered, just as embarrassed.
Don't apologize. Just get over it, for our sake and your own.
A silence fell over the room for a few seconds as everyone tried to regain their train of thought immediately preceding Ezra's and Julia's spat. Vin considered what the others said about his meld abilities and decided the captain was right. They needed to know the truth, and as he studied the people in the room, he had to admit he wanted to know for sure. Besides, this was something no one else could do. Taking a deep breath, Vin rose to his feet.
Vin?
Alex asked.
It's okay.
He met Chris's eyes, and the captain immediately understood.
It's time to bite the bullet.
I wish you would use another vernacular.
Ezra frowned.
In this place.
Shut up, Ezra.
Alex groaned and turned to Vin with a smile of encouragement.
You can do it.
Vin returned her smile with one of his own, hoping it allowed her to appreciate he had not meant to snap at her. The helmsman went to the bar, where the barmaid poured drinks for more waiting customers. Buck programmed her to look like Inez, and Vin had to confess the likeness was remarkable. No wonder it offended Inez initially. However, these days, Inez no longer wasted her time on such concerns when she still grieved at the loss of her fiancé.
How about a drink, darling?
Of course, senor.
She smiled radiantly, and Vin knew what Buck found so alluring about the woman. She was pretty, and the real Inez was even lovelier. She poured him whiskey straight up in a shot glass and slid the receptacle towards him when Vin caught her hand and lingered just enough to run his fingers over the smooth skin. The woman became somewhat offended when he did not let go. Worse yet, his expression became odd, almost as if he was deriving strange pleasure from the contact. Barmaid or not, such behavior was not tolerated, and she pulled her hand away, nearly knocking over the shot glass in her grip.
I think that is enough, senor.
More than a bit of ire showed in her voice as she glared at him angrily.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Vin quickly apologized, but he was unsettled. He barely noticed her gaze burning into his back when he returned to the table and the senior staff.
Jesus, Vin.
Buck declared immediately, seeing his expression.
You look like you've seen a ghost.
Not a ghost.
Vin shook his head, glancing over his shoulder at the barmaid.
Ghosts are dead. That woman is alive.
Chapter 6. Q. Even after the fact, it sounded impossible. Vin Tanner's declaration hung heavily in the air, soaking up the atmosphere surrounding the Starfleet officers seated around the table like an unfading stink despite the seconds ticking away slowly. They stared at the Vulcan who made the discovery, disbelieving at first because denial was the safest solution. To accept what Vin just said was to accept they were not in a dream or an illusion of light and magnetic containment, but trapped in a reality as absolute as their own presence in the cosmos. After Vin's meld with the bartender, it was the safest concept any of them could accept. Unfortunately, it could not last. As much as Chris wanted to believe this was still a program, and they were still on the Maverick, the overwhelming evidence gave him no such luxury. He was the captain, and what those under his command accepted with difficulty, he had to process with far speedier efficiency. All their lives depended on it. For the moment, however, he did away with the notion of how this could have happened and focused on the more immediate problem at hand, being why they were here. It seemed an odd place for an attack on his senior staff. Of all the programs, why would the enemy choose this place? To get out of here, they would have to find out why. At present, Chris's staff still grappled with the realization their fantasy world was somewhere real, with all the pitfalls that came with it. He looked up at them from his ruminations and heard them all grumbling amongst themselves, debating the results of Vin's meld with the bartender behind the bar. It was Julia who reacted first.
It's impossible. This is a holodeck fantasy.
I'm telling you, it's no fantasy.
Vin felt a little incensed about being questioned, mainly because he hated melding with anyone. He only agreed to it now because it was a necessary sacrifice to get to the bottom of things. It was uncomfortable enough dropping the shields he carefully erected around his telepathic abilities to prevent himself from picking up the stray thoughts without intentionally lowering them down. Vin found the whole thing distasteful enough without having someone doubt him.
I could feel that she was alive. I could hear what was running through her head. Normally, I get nothing from holograms. This only happens with sentient beings. I mean, I could tell she was tired from working all day, that she thinks Buck is kind of cute.
Really?
Buck glanced over his shoulder and looked at the woman in question.
That seems to settle it then,
Ezra remarked.
The lady is alive but has no taste.
If that's not being alive, I don't know what is.
Josiah suppressed a little smile at the dark look Buck flashed at Ezra. Children, he thought affectionately.
Okay.
Alex ignored the duo, mirroring Josiah's unspoken thought.
If this is real, why are we here?
That's an excellent question, Chris answered. Ideas, anyone?
I think it all connects to how we are here.
JD mused, thinking aloud.
This is not real. It can't be.
He's right.
Buck agreed.
The Magnificent Seven is fictional, a collection of stories. Some say it has its origins in a Japanese folktale about seven samurais without a shogun protecting a village from bandits. The Americans simply adopted it and fashioned their version into the program we now know.
So this could not be a case of time travel,
Nathan suggested.
No, we don't look like these characters, yet everybody here knows us as who we are in the Magnificent Seven folklore. If these people existed, they would be here. We would not need to be taking their places.
But if that's true, this gets more impossible by the minute.
Mary declared, wondering if this was any more puzzling to the others than it was to her.
Okay, if we're not in a simulation and in reality, where is this in reality? Nothing about this makes any sense except these people and this town was created for us. Only this place has far more complexity than any holodeck program.
I'm telling you, Mary. It's not a sophisticated holodeck program. These people are real. I heard her thoughts.
With all due respect, Vin, we have no way to confirm that.
What?
Alex bristled, not liking the insinuation.
If Vin says that's what he felt, then that's what he felt. What exactly are you alluding to, Lieutenant?
That he's misled.
Julia declared, just determined enough to show she was not about to back down.
I was not misled. I know what I felt.
Julia.
Ezra spoke up, aware Julia could be intractable when she thought she was right. It was difficult for her to accept what was not proven science. Julia's world was one of facts and materials she could see with her eyes and feel with her hands. He supposed something as outlandish as a fantasy world being given life was disconcerting for her.
I'm not saying you're wrong, but perhaps someone wished to make you believe all these people are alive.
Vin was getting really offended because Julia simply did not understand how personal melding was to a Vulcan. Chris could see the helmsman about to retaliate sharply when suddenly Buck cut in before he could.
All right.
Buck Wilmington spoke up with a loud voice, flexing his first officer's muscles to regain some order at the table.
People, we will not question each other, none of us.
He eyed the guilty parties pointedly.
Whoever put us here in this lousy position probably wants to see us tearing each other apart like a bunch of dogs and turning on ourselves. So we will not give them the satisfaction of playing their game or being puppets in this little extravaganza they have us performing in.
Once again, Buck's vehement words to the senior officers struck Chris the same way it did when Ezra had made a similar statement. Performance. Games. Players. Puppets. For a second, Chris said nothing. The drone of voices around the table grew distant as he focused on those variables and where he had heard them mentioned in the same breath once before. The connection stuck in his thoughts, grasping for the last piece to reach revelation. It came to him so suddenly that the explanation escaped him like a held breath. A weight lifted from him at the truth, and once he discovered it, he supposed it was the only explanation that made any sense. Buck immediately fell silent. The others saw the stillness in the first officer's face and turned to the captain.
I hope you're just talking about the alphabet.
Buck's voice was a whisper.
What are you talking about?
Alex turned to Buck and then Chris.
Q?
It was not surprising Alex and the rest of the command staff knew nothing about the omnipotent entity known as Q. Starfleet considered it classified information released only to command-level personnel with the rank of commander or higher. Starfleet did not wish it known there was a race of beings with the power of gods roaming around the galaxy capable of turning time, space, and dimensional realities on its ear at a moment's notice. The directive from Starfleet was to keep the information on the Q continuum on a strict need-to-know basis. Only a handful of people outside Starfleet and the Federation Council knew of its existence. However, Chris could find no other explanation for what was happening here. It made perfect sense. After reading the data logs written by Jean-Luc Picard and Benjamin Sisko, Chris realized this was a textbook version of Q using them as instruments for his amusement. It was well within Q's abilities to take them off the Maverick and insert them into this make-believe world. Furthermore, the villains thrown at them since their arrival was consistent with the entity's idea of deadly play.
Surely you jest,
Ezra exclaimed. He understood what the word Q had meant, other than its alphabetical reference.
How do you know about it?
Buck looked at him suspiciously since it was restricted information. Then again, Buck also knew Ezra was no ordinary officer. The man was an excellent security chief because he knew when to keep his ear to the ground and listen for information that was usually a mystery to most. If anyone could find out about Q, it was Ezra Standish.
One hears outlandish stories all the time.
Ezra shrugged, not wishing to divulge too closely his source of information.
Suffice to say, I know who Q is.
Well, I don't know who Q is,
Alex declared, annoyed.
Care to fill the rest of us in?
I know about him too,
Nathan confessed.
When I started the research in the Borg assimilation process, they let me see all the records regarding this Q and his presence on the Enterprise during the first encounter with the Collective.
That would make sense, Chris thought to himself. As one of the foremost Borg researchers in the Federation, Nathan would have had access to all the data regarding the Collective. This included the details of the Enterprise's first encounter with the species. Seeing the expectation in the eyes of the others awaiting their captain to explain to them who and what this Q was, Chris decided there was no reason to keep the truth from them. Starfleet restricted all information about Q as need to know, and at this moment, his senior staff needed to know. Q is an alien entity, unlike anything we have ever seen. Scientists have determined that he is a life form composed of pure energy, capable of manipulating all forms of it, down to the temporal level. It is the most advanced life form we have ever encountered. Q comes from a race of such beings calling themselves the Q Continuum. However,
Because they have what can justifiably be called omnipotent qualities, their evolution has risen beyond the need for the structure of what we call civilization. They travel throughout the cosmos and amuse themselves any way they can. I suppose when you have the power to do anything and everything, plus the added benefit of being immortal, there comes a time when you realize there is nothing left to do.
Are you saying this thing has us?
It horrified Josiah to think of so much power in the hands of one being. Invincibility coupled with immortality could create megalomania on a scale that disregarded conscience or regret. Josiah shuddered, thinking he might be in the grasp of such a creature.
How come we've never heard of this Q?
Julia demanded, unable to imagine such a life form existing. It was wrong for any one species to have that much power. It did not seem to keep with the balance of nature. Starfleet agreed it was probably wise for the public to not know there was an entity like this drifting about the place. The Q have a tendency to play, using other life forms for amusement, but they do not murder or cause permanent harm to any of their pawns. The Enterprise had several encounters with a Q who seemed fascinated by humans. Picard believes perhaps in an earlier stage of their evolution, the Q may have been like us, which might explain why they keep appearing before humans.
So we're basically at the mercy of this thing?
Vin could imagine nothing worse than playing puppet to some omnipotent being's fantasy. More or less, assuming that I'm right, Chris nodded in answer.
Is there any way we can confirm it?
Alex asked.
With all due respect, Captain, I'm not doubting your word, but if you said this Q's interest has mainly been with the Enterprise, what is it about us that suddenly captured their attention, and of all the programs, why this one?
Good question,
Buck remarked.
I'd like to know that myself.
Well, it's one in which we all have a part,
JD suggested.
If you want the entire command staff involved, this is it.
That's a point,
Buck agreed.
Possibly, however, until we know more, we are all staying together. This is an extremely powerful entity capable of erasing us from existence with a thought.
Wonderful,
Ezra sighed.
Now that we know who placed us here, are we simply to perform for our supper?
He looked in Chris's direction. The others followed suit, wondering the same thing themselves. Chris's jaw tensed, and he looked at them with ice in his eyes.
Absolutely not. We will do nothing to give Q any more fun than he's already had at our expense. Come on, we're getting out of here. We need to talk freely, and we can't do it in this place.
What about the Clarion News office?
Mary suggested.
It's closest.
Chris nodded in agreement with that idea.
Fine, let's get going.
He rose to his feet and gestured for the others to follow. Following the captain, the senior staff vacated the establishment and stepped into the street. Unfortunately, their numbers made it impossible to look inconspicuous, not to mention that they were the central characters in this little drama. They were a curious bunch of 7 men and 3 women, and they moved through 4 corners like a tornado moving through the fictional town, drawing all the attention of the 7 to them. It was not a comforting feeling. Although he explained much about the Q and the entity's habits, Vin could tell Chris was holding something back. The helmsman's connection with the captain provided him with an insight into what was on the captain's mind. Vin suspected it might have resulted from lacking the proper mental disciplines possessed by Vulcans trained from childhood. While he could now protect his own mind and others by learning how to develop shields, Vin accepted his skills were rudimentary. Deep emotional bonds, such as the ones Vin shared with the captain and Alex, allowed him to get impressions from them. What he now sensed from Chris filled him with foreboding because he felt the captain's fear. Chris Larrabee was not a man afraid of anything, but if this Q was merely playing them for amusement, playing a game of catch and release, why was Chris so worried?
Chris,
he caught up to the captain as the man led his crew towards the offices of the Clarion News to gain some privacy while they decided upon some course of action.
What is it?
Chris grimaced, hating that Vin could sometimes tell what was going on behind his eyes.
Q's at the bottom of this all right, but something is wrong.
How so?
From all of Picard's log reports, Chris explained quietly as he and Vin kept ahead of the others.
From all of Picard's log reports, Q is in the habit of showing himself. Part of his fun is getting involved in the action, to goad and taunt his victims with his superiority.
I guess we're lucky he spared us that,
Vin remarked, not seeing why Chris was so fearful.
Lucky? Why? Why are we so lucky? What's different about us that makes him change his pattern?
Vin could not answer and merely shook his head in response.
I'm worried, Vin. If he's suddenly changed his pattern in this aspect of his behavior, what else has changed? Q can destroy us all with a thought. What if he decides it's okay to kill us? We won't be able to do a damn thing about it.
That thought was disconcerting, and Vint felt his insides knot up in helplessness.
Damn.
Suddenly, Vint Hanner wished for Q to make an appearance. However, when they turned the corner towards the street, taking them to the offices of the Clarion News, what they found was not an omnipotent being but a dozen men, armed and waiting. Top Hat Bob, who stood at the head of the deadly party, with his eye patch and his dusty top hat, glared at the captain through his good eye in a triumphant leer.
Larrabee, get ready to die!
Chris wondered if it was too late to change his holodeck preferences to Buck, Sorgi, and Risa,